bear it down to be in flight. It wasn't about me, it was only a stone in my shoe. Then worries came to perch on us, impatience and a painted bus. I kept you close to me, close to my ear. We set out once with folded shirts, with hairy chests and no rehearse. I wanted all for myself. I sat right between your eyes, your shoulder blade, your running life. I wanted all for myself. Improving all the time I am, improving as I kiss the hem. I promise I won't be a trouble at all, for I'm okay, I'm in the red. Impressions of the unmade bed, you cradle close to me, close to my ear. We set out once, forget our shirts, every chest and no rehearse. I wanted all for myself. For in the earth I smell of you, a baby boy, amazing view. I wanted all for
making sure this is all working out. My name is Mitch Saunders. You're listening to Swing Politics with Big Mitch. And it's been a while since I've been on the air here. I was normally doing the 6 a.m. slot every Wednesday or Thursday. Every week or every other week in the early part of 2023. And I am so happy to be back on the air to talk about some important political things going on once again. Yeah, it's been a crazy year. The reason why I wasn't here was that I was abroad in London. And now I am ready to get back and ready to jump right back into stuff. So let's get started. So what has been going on in the political world as of late? I think the most recent thing that we can talk about right now is the border security bill that is currently pushing its way through Congress, or not so much pushing, rather than it has sort of prostrated itself, fell face flat in a bill that seems like it's not going to get passed for something that Republicans have been clamoring for since the end of the Bush era. And with this border security bill, it was a bipartisan bill that was created by a group of Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. And they worked together for many months. A notable Democrat on it, now independent, is was Kyrsten Sinema. And the big GOP advocate for it was Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma. And boy, did they throw him under the bus. But we'll go through the details first. I think that's the most important part. So the details are, to give a few of them, is that the bill would include increased funding for immigration and customs enforcement, especially for increased detention capacity, speeds up the revenue of asylum claims, shutting down the border if there is a daily illegal crossing topping 5,000 migrants on average, or 8,500 in a single day. $1.4 billion would be dispersed to help states and local governments fending off the or handling the influx of immigrants. That would especially go to places like New York, Boston, D.C., basically major cities along the eastern coast, as the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, continues to send migrants up to these cities, causing an issue that he likes to politically play up, as well as all Republicans do. This bill would also amp up the Fend Off Fentanyl Act, which essentially just ensures that just helps with preventing fentanyl from coming across the border. And there's a bit of a myth with that we will be getting into in a second. And providing extra funding to customs and border protection for more manpower, essentially. It's a very interesting bill because it's the most conservative immigration policy for a Democratic president and a Democratic policy. A Democratic Party since probably Clinton, if he even did support anything immigration-wise that was this strict. What's so notable is that in the debates going on for this bill, Democrats have taken on increasingly difficult positions that they're not totally happy with, but it's worth it to get something done and to be able to say that they did something. And the reaction, how the voters would behave if this were passed, is sort of a different story. But it's super interesting that Democrats have been very much sort of going against their ideals in terms of immigration. They know things have to be done. They don't want to do it in this way. But they'd rather get something done and say that they're handling something rather than doing nothing and letting the problem happen, because border crossings are much higher than they have been in the past. And a lot of that has to do with with the policy decisions that Trump made, which, again, I'll be getting into in the future. But it is something that I think would benefit the Democrats politically if they were to pass it. However, it's dead in the water. It's crazy that this Senator Lankford, who's just, you know, a normie Republican in the caucus, put his neck on the line, and even McConnell has come out and said, no, really, we're not going to end up passing this bill. And even if it does pass or get 60 votes for cloture in the Senate, because not all Democrats are certain to vote on this, and not all, and definitely not all, if not a, you know, critical mass of Republicans are to vote on this in the Senate, in the House, it's dead on arrival. Senator Johnson has said he will not bring the bill up to the floor. It's possible that the Democrats and a group of Republicans could bring it to the floor as a discharge petition to sort of circumvent that rule, but you would need to get 2/3 vote, from what I understand, in the Senate or in the House for it to pass. The details of how the bill would pass is a little bit murky. But the short answer of the short story of all of this is that the bill's not going to go anywhere, and all of these conservative policies that Democrats have made points to sort of give up and say to Republicans, look, it's fine, we'll give you this win. You've been asking for this since forever, and we know that these are important, and we're going to be able to say that we did something, and you'll get the policy win. However, the leading Republican contender and presumptive nominee for president has has applied a great deal of pressure on his party to not let this pass. And this is why, this is where there's so much tension arising, that there are Republicans that have worked on this and Democrats that have worked on this for many months. And Trump has come out and said, I don't want to give Biden any wins before the election. And if you pass this bill, it's going to make him look better because it looks like he's tough on immigration. And then I cannot complain about that on the campaign trail. That's what he's telling Republicans. And Mitch McConnell, who was supposedly so upset about the insurrection and was very sort of afraid of the direction that Trump was bringing the party, and his relative moderatism to Trump has not really materialized in terms of actual resistance. McConnell is perfectly fine with Trump winning again, Republicans keeping the Senate, and that's the way that it goes. McConnell sees no problem in Trump coming back because, hey, we can appoint more judges. Because that's McConnell's whole shtick. The fact that McConnell has come out and said, and he's sort of the part of the quote-unquote anti-Trump faction of the GOP in the Senate, meaning he's not fully gung-ho for him. The fact that he's completely bent the knee to what Trump has been set, to what Trump has requested, is, it's frightening, and it's a little shocking in my opinion, considering in 2013, Republicans had come up, another bipartisan group in the Senate had come up with a very similar, strict conservative immigration plan. And it was House Republicans who shot it down, because Republicans don't really care about governing or trying to make things better. They care about doing the worst for the greatest number of people and making sure that the good guys can't get anything done so that they can win in the next election, or at least deflect enough in the next election so that either Democrats don't win overwhelmingly and they have divided government, or Republicans win full control. It's unclear how the bill would specifically impact the status of the border before the election. I don't know how it would change and how maybe cities would feel the effects of this, or the border would maybe sort of have a little bit more organization and less illegal crossing. I really don't know. I don't know how exactly the whole thing would shake up. But what I do know is that passing this bill would definitely upset young voters and progressives on the Democratic Party. But it would also help Biden and Dems appealing to those who say that immigration and border security is a big problem. The progressives and the young voters are a tiny sect that rarely vote, whereas a majority in almost every poll see immigration and border security as issues that need to be addressed. And I think that it's... the issue is also trumped up in the news, especially by the GOP. I think that Fox News has taken it and ran with it, and because Fox News has taken it, now CNN and MSNBC have to cover it because it's both sidesism. I don't think that the situation is as bad as Republicans like to say it is, but regardless of whether it is an issue or it isn't an issue, it is perceived as an issue in the eyes of voters. And because of that, it needs to be addressed. In my opinion, Trump telling Republicans to shoot down this deal is politically very expedient and intelligent. I think that from a Republican standpoint, from a traditional Republican standpoint, is why would you ever want to work with a Democratic Party on anything, a Democratic president? You want to make him seem as weak as possible, and this is the way to do that. Say, look at him, Biden really can't make any changes happen on the border. Look at how cities are being overwhelmed, and the whole urban city myth about how dangerous living in a city is. And, it's really just a sort of call to, racism and xenophobia in that sense, in that cities have racial diversity and ethnic diversity that, and they happen to vote for Democrats. And Republicans don't like that. So instead of being overtly racist, they'll just say, oh, cities are so dangerous, you never want to move to a city, and frighten their viewership. I think there was a big deal about Chicago. Everyone was saying, everyone thinks now, oh, Chicago's so dangerous, when it's a vibrant city with crime rates that have dropped since 2013, and actually D.C. has a higher crime rate than Chicago. So, went down a little bit of a rabbit hole there. However, the fact that immigration and border security is perceived as an issue that needs to be addressed by voters makes it something that needs to be addressed, whether or not it is an actual issue. And Republicans, Trump directing his party to not give Biden that win is very, very smart for his campaign. Because if Biden were to be able to run on that, it would look good for his campaign because young voters, progressive voters don't vote. And also, I'll be getting into this, but the fact that Trump is making gains with young voters is sort of going to happen either way. But I'll be getting into that in a second. I think that it would help with swing voters, independent voters, and those are the voters that count the most. So there's a lot of the border issue today, which is objectively worse than it's been in the past. The degree to which it's been worse is a different discussion, but there's a representative in Congress. His name is Jerry Connolly. He represents Virginia, a district in Virginia, and he has a really interesting article that I found online on his website that does a good job of talking about the myths and the facts of the reality of the border, the state of the border, and the state of immigration. And a lot of the issues are shockingly, you know, believe it or not, caused by Trump. And that's what we're feeling now, because Republicans love to cause issues. They love to cause border problems, and they love to cause economic catastrophes, and then blame it on the Democrats if the economy isn't recovering perfectly, so they can get back into power. And in this case, it's a very similar thing. Trump removed pathways to citizenship, a great number of them, and he also challenged DACA at the Supreme Court, regardless of whether or not it was upheld. Trump placed sanctions on Cuba and other Latin American countries. So that's going to put strain on the economy of those countries, cause more volatility macroeconomically, and there will be a greater need for a greater number of people to migrate to the states because they don't have another option, and that was Trump's doing. Biden, on the other hand, in the fiscal year 2023 budget, the funding package, he increased Border Patrol funding for more agents, more personnel, points of entry, and greater technology. And Republicans voted against this. Republicans voted against this border security increase in funding. To say that you want a tighter, more secure border and then to vote against that border funding, or in this case, the immigration bill that Republicans have been wanting since 2013, since they had come up with it in 2013 before when they were working on it in 2012, it's unfathomable. But it also makes perfect sense politically. And in my opinion, it's one of the smartest moves that Republicans have made in the last 7 years, 8 years. The myth in there's something in the bill about, the fentanyl, the Fend Off Fentanyl Act, which is important because it's important to fend off fentanyl, of course. But the issue that fentanyl is flowing over the borders, just absolutely careening and streaming into Texas and the border states, and then it's heading up. The reality of the situation is that fentanyl is not being seized at the border. In December 2022, Border Patrol seized 4,500 pounds of fentanyl, and 5 pounds of it was seized at the border. 4,500. And 5 pounds of fentanyl was seized at the border. The argument that immigrants are dangerous and they're causing problems and that they are, horrible to the American way of life and they're murderers and rapists and all of those accusations are, of course, false and have been debunked every time. Immigrants are less likely to be in those altercations. Are less likely to perpetrate those things than average white Americans. So, it seems like the border bill is dead. And that's, in my opinion, good for Republicans. Independent of the policy, Democrats will likely not be able to campaign on a border security bill. And it's hard for Democrats to make the case now that Republicans will not be on the line to vote for it or against it. It's very difficult for Democrats to be making advertisements, to be saying messaging that there was a border security bill and Republicans voted against it. Maybe in the Senate. There's not that many senators up on the Republican side this year. Really, it's just Ted Cruz and Rick Scott who are the only two Republican vulnerabilities. It's all Democrats for the most part in the Senate cycle, which is what makes it so hard for Democrats to possibly regain full control of government. And appealing to the swing voters is what this bill did, and it would have given Democrats a win. And so I think that it's regardless of the policy, would have been really interesting to see how it would have played out, how it would have affected the rest of the year in terms of border security. But this is the most conservative bill that Democrats are going to be putting up. There's nothing else that they're going to propose. So this is it for the border bill, and it's certainly dead. Instead of the House being the issue, less of the Republicans in the Senate, the House just passed a bill that would expand the child tax credit and also provide business tax exemptions to keep manufacturing domestic and strong. And I think this is a really interesting bill because it passed with a great deal of bipartisan support. Only the far left and the far right of both parties opposed it. And now the Senate is unsure that they're going to pass it. So isn't that something? Now it's not the House that's the problem. It's the Senate. The House just passed a great bill with the Republican speaker. They were able to pass something where both sides got something, and it helps the U.S. economy overall, and it helps the U.S. economy and the state of welfare for individuals who need it the most, like the child tax credit. And the Senate is now unsure if they're going to pass it, and the time is ticking. And there hasn't been any direction from Trump, but the idea is just to not give Biden any wins going into an election cycle, which is how Republicans should play it. But it means they're not governing, which is fine. But if Democrats are going into this cycle without any big legislative wins that are going to be signed, they need to be very, very strict in terms of their communication and say that Trump directed Republicans to vote against border security, which would be a very, very strong argument, very strong talking point. So, because these policies, it's unclear about the child tax credit, tax business credit thing, that bill, but it seems like the border bill is dead. It's unclear, it's clear that this election cycle will be shaped extremely by ads and smart ads. And so this will lead into sort of my next topic of discussion, which is the FEC numbers for Biden and Trump that have recently come out. Because February 1st is the FEC deadline for reporting for the 2024 campaign cycle. So all the funding, all the numbers that they have in the background then become public on February 1st of the election year. So the numbers say that advertising is going to be something that I'll be looking into a great deal. Media markets are made up of various sections from all over the country that sort of go they're interstate. Some media markets are much more expensive. Some media markets are much cheaper. And this is stuff that I'm going to be looking into extensively in this election cycle. But in terms of the money that both campaigns made, Biden and the DNC and the fundraising committees and vehicles that he has working for his campaign in total raised $117 million, with $67 million of it coming from individual donors. It's a pretty good haul. It's it's fine. Like, it's a lot of money. It's good. It's good for that was the second half of 2023 that they made that money. Now, if you compare it to 4 years ago, Trump and his committees had $170 million at the exact same time. Now, one could interpret that as indication that Biden is not really, it doesn't have the enthusiasm that Trump has. It's not looking great for him in re-election. And you might come to that conclusion, but this is not the reason why you should come to that conclusion. Because Trump had $170 million at this time, and Trump's notorious for being a very good fundraiser, whereas Biden is not really as, he's not as animating for the Democratic base as Trump is for the Republican base. But Biden isn't running against Trump in 2020. Biden's running against Trump in 2024. And Trump's 2024 campaign in the last half of 2023 raised $75 million, which is less than certainly the $107 million that Biden raised. But here's the kicker. $50 million of this is being spent on Trump's legal defenses. So Biden is around quadrupling the number that Trump is left to work with for his campaigning, for his advertisements, for everything that he needs for to run his campaign. So the importance of advertising in this case, especially when bills are not going to be passed for Biden in this election year, most likely, is that the advertising shapes the entire narrative. The advertising allows for the opponent to be shaped as well as the incumbent. So in these advertisements, Biden's going to talk about his accomplishments with the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, with the Inflation Reduction Act, with his COVID relief policies, with his with the bounce back of the economy, with inflation cooling, with the need to codify Roe. And then on the other side, you're going to attack Trump on the things for January 6th. You're going to attack him for destroying Roe v. Wade and abortion rights. You're going to attack him for preventing border security bills from being passed, as was mentioned before. All of the things that are largely supported by the population at large, the voting population. And Trump cannot, at this point, parry that. He cannot put out a number of his ads that will flood the airwaves in a way that Biden's would. And I think that that's extremely interesting, because these legal defense payments are not going anywhere. They're not going to be going anywhere, because he's going to be in trials through the election. So I think that Biden raising money that's less than Trump did in 2020 at this stage is not indicative at all of anything ever, because it's not a race between Biden from this year and Trump from 4 years ago. It's a horse race between these two right now. And these two right now, Trump is losing the money battle, something that he's always been hallmarked for as a Republican candidate. He is losing the money battle to a Democratic Party that understands how to appeal to voters and the issues that matter in a moderate way, because the Republican Party is viewed as more extreme than the Democratic Party. And that's a good thing, and Democrats need to maintain that. But something that could really help buoy Trump's campaign is the choice of his vice president. And that is a discussion that the media has picked up on a lot. They have a lot of speculation on who it is going to be, on the sort of impact that those have. And I have spoken about that on my blog, Swing Politics, if you want to check it out, swingpolitics.com. I have sort of given my insights on what on the four contenders that I feel it might be. And the top two that I would say is you have Elise Stefanik, who is the third ranking member of the GOP in the House right now. She is from upstate New York. She was elected in 2014 as a Bush-type moderate. She worked in Bush administration. And in 2016, she took a hard right turn for Trump and has not looked back. And the other option is Tim Scott. He is a senator from South Carolina. He was appointed by Nikki Haley in 2016, which is interesting because Scott just endorsed Trump over Haley, who appointed Scott to the Senate. He was appointed in 2013 or 2016. I don't quite recall. Maybe 2015. But he was appointed by Haley. He ran for re-election in 2016, ran for re-election again in 2022. He wins by solid margins. It's a state that's extremely Republican, but he does get a lot of crossover voters. The two of them are both extremely savvy in their own rights. I think that Stefanik is very good at sort of going against her beliefs, but two, speaking in a fiery manner for Trump in a way that is also media coached. I think that if you look at Trump and you look at maybe some of his opponents on the debate stage, like Vivek Ramaswamy specifically, or if you think about a possible contender for the VP like Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, these people are a little bit less tame in their speaking. And because they're less tame, it would make Trump's ticket seem more unruly and not reeled in, which is the exact energy that Trump needs to counter. Trump's a loose cannon. And he'll sort of say whatever he wants. And the reason why Mike Pence in 2016 and 2020 was such a good choice is because he was just a normie Republican who was good with evangelicals, who spoke very, very calm, very collected, very Washington. And that's what I think both of these candidates are specifically. I think that they're both very Washington. They know how to seem like they're reeling in someone who cannot be reeled in, and being a part of a Republican Party that is so extreme while also talking about it in a light that is of the Tea Party era and of the pre-Trump era, because both of them are pre-Trump. Stefanik, I think, does it a little bit better because she's fiery in a way that is, she's a little bit more of a cutthroat speaker, and a little bit more of a jugular type attacker. Scott, on the other hand, I find to be more tame in a way that's like, he will discuss the policy, but he will not really go on offense as much. I think the debate stage in 2024, in these debates for the Republican nomination, highlighted him as not a particularly strong speaker, and that he speaks very well when it is a press conference or in a committee hearing, but it's a very different beast when it's on the national political stage. And I think that in some ways that does make Trump's candidacy appealing. I'm not sure if you want someone who is contained but fiery versus just contained, because I think that Scott is very similar to a Pence, as a Pence choice was in 2016-2020. And I don't know if Trump wants to repeat that. Whereas Stefanik is very different. Tim Scott would have acted very similar as Pence in terms of the January 6th insurrection. He would have made sure the electors were certified, and he wouldn't have gone against sort of the democratic process. Stefanik, it's more of a question, and I think it's very possible that she would have gone against the electoral counting and tried to throw a wrench into things and prevent Biden from becoming president, whether or not it would have actually succeeded. I think her fealty to Trump is a bit stronger than Scott's. In terms of which one Trump would choose, I think that he prefers Stefanik in my mind, because of how loyal she has been, whereas Trump has worked with Scott on policy in 2016 and 20 for his term, and Scott has not held back in terms of some criticisms. He hasn't been overtly sort of antagonistic of the Trump administration, but he was critical at points. And I think that Trump wants someone who has an undying loyalty to what he believes is his cause. In terms of him getting elected, in terms of the appeal that both of them have to voters, Stefanik is a good choice because of the environment that we're in. We're in the first presidential election after the destruction of Roe at the hands of the Supreme Court appointed by Donald Trump. To not have a woman as his running mate would be a mistake, I think. It would be turning a blind eye to one of the biggest issues on the ballot. Now, it is true that it might not materialize as such if the election is a referendum on Biden. But if it is not, abortion's going to be, and still is, regardless, a very salient issue. The issue that abortion is most salient for is Democrats, but it's also for independents and swing voters. And even soft Republicans. Almost all Nikki Haley voters are very much against the Dobbs decision that gutted abortion rights. And those Nikki Haley voters, and those Nikki Haley primary voters, are also Joe Biden general election voters. But still, I think that the fact that Stefanik is a woman, regardless of her beliefs on abortion, which are extreme and possibly the same as Trump's, if not more extreme, is her. Yeah, regardless of her beliefs, the image of her standing next to Trump, arm in arm, or her sort of over his shoulder, something in that regard, as a team, would be very helpful for swing voters or independent voters or Republicans that are sort of softer on Trump. Soft Republicans meaning like they're not totally committed to him, but they would, like to vote for him because they don't like Joe Biden, but they're not totally sure. She would help bring a sense of moderatism in that sense for abortion and for women's rights that would very likely speak to female voters, regardless of what Stefanik believes on abortion. And I think that it would be a mistake for him not to choose a woman in the environment that we're in currently. That being said, someone like Kristi Noem would not be a good choice. So it's not just any woman, but it's a woman that helps his appeal. And I think that it's a very important thing for voters to see. So the next option that Trump might choose is Tim Scott. And Tim Scott, as I said, is senator from South Carolina. He has sort of the insider appeal. He is someone that is very much the moderate supposed moderate, regardless of the policy that he believes, that voters would like to see as well. And I also think that it's something that needs to be discussed, that the fact that Tim Scott is African-American and that there has been some information within polling, which is what I'm going to get into possibly next week, but we'll see, about the fact that Biden has shown weaknesses with African-Americans in terms of his polling And Scott would help Trump, especially with black male voters, sort of claw them away from the Democratic coalition and from Biden's coalition. I also think that Scott would be good for just, in general, moderate voters, swing voters, Republicans who are not so sure on Trump, because I think that there is something to be said for in sort of insider, a Tea Party type guy, a moderate, regardless of what their policies are, because their policies are the same as Trump's. It's the perception. It's the way that voters see the campaign. And he's not working with much ad money now, as I said already. So he really needs something to beef up this operation. And choosing a new vice president juices support. I think either of those options are very good for his campaign. And sort of the Biden campaign has to work with parrying and making sure that those candidates are painted in a light that makes them look just as extreme as Trump, which will be a hard thing to do. So, as I was mentioning before, in terms of the polling and the sort of crosstabs with especially minority support, African-American support, we're seeing in these polls there's a bit of an age depolarization and a race depolarization, not to a great extent, but you have young voters moving away from specifically Biden, not necessarily the Democratic Party, but Biden, and you have African-American voters and Hispanic voters also moving away from Biden. The degree to which this is happening in the polls says that Trump is winning anywhere between 15 to 30% of the black vote. That would be the highest of any Republican presidential nominee since Ford, who got like 16% of the African-American vote. So I'm skeptical to believe that this is the case, because it's very possible that Trump could make inroads with, he got, I believe, 12% of the black vote in 2020. It's very possible that he could increase this because black voters are not so happy with the legacy of the Biden administration, or at least it hasn't been translated to them and they haven't felt the effects of the policy that the Biden administration has passed. But I do not believe that Trump will be getting anywhere near 30% of the black vote. In terms of age, it's a very similar thing, where Trump in some polls is leading in the 18 to 35 age category. That is not going to happen. And especially because young voters are one of the most educated groups, I think that the polls are doing a few things. The first is that they're trying to make a horse race media narrative. There is sort of no telling what the polls say now versus what the election results will be. I believe the margin of error is like something like 10% today for polls compared to what the election result will be in November. And the idea that Trump is a possible contender is very different from what it was in 2020, when Biden was leading in every poll, some by double digits. I think that there's that horse race idea for ratings, because network media's ratings have been down since Trump left office, is a way to view more eyeballs and also gets polling companies to herd their results. So they're all going to say that Trump is doing that Trump is sort of leading Biden. Biden's not doing well, and whether or not this is the case is a different story. And because there's a Quinnipiac poll that says Biden's leading the nation, leading nationally by 6, and then there's a CBS or Siena poll that says Trump is leading by 4. That's a big delta between those two. And I think that the Trump effect is something that pollsters haven't figured out, and I think that they're overcorrecting for it. In 2016, it was not waiting by education. That was the biggest one in 2016. In 2020, they waited by education, but they didn't wait by recalled vote, or not as much, and that created more of a Biden-skewed result. And I think that they just haven't figured out how to nail Trump with elections. In 2018 and 2022, nonpartisan pollsters were pretty accurate. They were very good. I think that Trump on the ballot is a totally different thing. And I think that presidential polling has not been accurate in the last two election cycles, which makes me hesitant to believe anything that's coming out. What I will say, though, is that it is much better for Biden and the Democrats to have polling that is close, to have polling that says Trump is ahead, because it actually motivates the base to turn out. In 2020, I believe that you had a final poll in Wisconsin from Marquette that had Biden leading by 17 points when he won the state by 0.6. It's very possible that with COVID happening in 2020 and people feeling like Biden was going to win in a landslide, they did not want to turn out. They didn't feel that their vote would really matter because it was that the end was that Biden was going to end up being the president and that Trump would just end up fading into history. And that didn't really happen when Trump only barely lost by about 50,000 votes in the right places. So the polls being close might not allow Democrats to rest on their laurels this time. Which for the Biden campaign, in my mind, yes, the polling doesn't look so peachy, but I would hope that sort of pollsters would be smarter than they were in 2020 in a lot of ways. I think that is where I'm going to leave it for today. There's going to be much more next week, as there is always. Update. Next week, actually, I won't be here, but the week after, I will be discussing the results of a special election and some more polls that come out and some more info on what's going on in Congress. So this is Mitch Saunders with Swing Politics. You're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Thanks for listening in. I can know you.
gonna say it again. I say you and me, we got chemistry. Baby, you and me, could this be that chemistry? Baby, you and me,
you and me,
we got chemistry. Baby, you and me, can you start to see that chemistry? Baby, you and me.
Afraid that I think of her at that time of day, so